This podcast is brought to you by Knowledge at Wharton.
Welcome to Knowledge at Wharton. I'm Angie Bassiani. With me today is Dr. Stuart Friedman. He's the author of Baby Bust, New Choices for Men and Women in Work and Family. It's a really interesting look at how our competitive, demanding work culture in the United States is leading more and more young people to question whether they want to become parents or even have families. Dr. Friedman is an organizational psychologist. He joined the Wharton staff in 1984, and in early 1990s set up two of the seminal programs here at the university, the Wharton Leadership Program and the Wharton Work-Life Integration Project. He has been a sought-after expert in the topic of work-life balance, and he's won numerous awards for his teaching excellence. Now he is an emeritus practice professor of management. Stu, thanks for joining me.
So great to be here, Angie. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Well, we have something to celebrate today because it's the 10th anniversary of Baby Bust, so it's been reissued to mark the occasion. Congratulations, that's an achievement.
Thank you. I'm very glad to have this new edition and grateful to the Wharton Press for doing it.
Absolutely. Well, this book is based on your research using Wharton graduates as your subject matter. You talked to the class of 1992, and then 20 years later, the class of 2012, you surveyed them about their perceptions and their attitudes about work and family. Give us a bit of an overview and really what inspired you to write this book.
Well, back in the 80s, I was doing research and practice, working with organizations on leadership development, talent management for how companies prepared and selected their senior executives. That was my dissertation at the University of Michigan. That's what I'd been working on. And it was all going quite swimmingly when a few years into that, in the late 80s, I became a father for the first time. And that sort of changed things for me. And I realized at that moment of meeting my son for the first time that I had a new question to pursue. And that was, how am I going to contribute to making the world one in which he's going to flourish? So I brought that question to everyone, including my students in the Wharton School in the MBA program, and asked, what are you as future business leaders going to do about cultivating not just the next generation of talent in your companies, but the next generation, full stop? And that conversation led me to become a lot more active in doing research, starting to develop teaching models, and sharing knowledge about how people integrate the different parts of their lives for mutual gain. It led to the start of the Work-Life Integration Project, which did research in the field, finding people who were good at this and identifying what it was about what they did that helped them to find harmony among the different parts of their lives as parents and in other aspects of their lives. We also did large-scale survey research starting in 1992. Which was the basis, the original basis for the Baby Bust study. So we started tracking different classes of Wharton students. And as the project grew and aged, and as I aged, we decided 20 years after the initial study, the first in a series of studies, we decided to go back to the class of 1992 and ask them a series of questions about their lives, their careers, their hopes, their dreams, their passions, their interests, their political views, lots and lots of questions about who they are as people. But we also surveyed the class of 2012, which enabled us to do a cross-generational study 20 years apart. So we compared the class of 1992 when they graduated and the class of 2012 when they graduated. So we had a true cross-generational comparison. That's the study that Baby Bust is about. And now 10 years after that study, I've had a chance to provide some new commentary on what we observed then, in 2012 or 2013 was actually when the study was published. And now, 10 years later, the main finding, the thing that really struck me when I looked at the data comparing the class of 1992 to the class of 2012 was what men and women were saying about their interests in planning to have or adopt children. In 1992, about 78-79% of men and women said that they planned to have or adopt children. So the response scale was yes, probably, not sure, probably not, and no. So 78-79% men and women said yes or probably in 1992. In 2012, that number dropped to 42-43%.
That's really dramatic.
It was crazy. I thought, no, that can't be. That's just too huge a drop. But it was true. So that became kind of the focal point for looking at what had changed when we studied the Gen Xers compared to the millennials. And so in the book, what I do is to describe what changed and why, and how the story is a little bit different for men and women as to why fewer young people were planning to have or adopt children.
Let's talk a little bit about that. First of all, I do want to show the book. Here it is. This is the newest edition with the orange cover. There is a striking number of differences in the attitudes and the perceptions between the Gen Xers and the millennials. Some things were similar. As you put it in the book, there's good news and there's bad news. Can you highlight some of those differences that you found for us?
Well, people are less likely to want to have children now. I thought, indeed the original response to the book was, oh, that's just Wharton students. We can't really generalize. Well, it turns out that these are trends that are both national and global. I became much more knowledgeable about trends in birth rates because I had to try to learn something about what it was we were observing among Wharton students and now alumni. It turns out these are not isolated findings among, you know, these elite business school students. These are broader findings. And there are a number of reasons that explain why men and women shifted in their interests, their willingness to want to have kids of their own. It's not that they think any less about the importance of long-term relationships or even becoming a parent. It's still an important part of life. It's just that many, many fewer of them are planning to actually do it. For men, it had to do in part with having a different attitude about what a modern father is, a different father than the one that they had in terms of their role in the family, wanting to be more involved, more active, and also wanting to be able to fund their family's needs and their concerns about that. So we found that people, young men who were carrying a high level of student debt, for example, they were less likely to want to have kids because they were afraid that they couldn't provide the support. They also anticipated greater conflict in their relationships because of their expected amount of engagement in the role of father and how that was going to conflict with their being, you know, successful in their careers. Women, on the other hand, had very different reasons for their reduced interest in having children. One was greater freedom. They had a greater sense of choosing not to become a mother compared to their Gen Xers before them, that the social pressures to become a mother were not as great. They also were conflicted about their role in society. More women who felt that it was important for them to be contributing to social good through their work, those people saw a conflict between that role and their ability to have the time and attention that they wanted for children. So those are just some of the ways in which men and women shifted over the course of those two generations.
I think for me, what really struck me about that shift, that change, is almost like the Gen X cohort had these rose-colored glasses on, right? The idea that they could achieve it, they could do it all. And the millennials went into it with their eyes wide open. You mentioned in the book, they're concerned about student debt, they're concerned about climate change, they're concerned about social injustice. It reminded me of a Betty Friedan, the famous Betty Friedan quote, you can have it all, just not at the same time. And it felt like the millennials kind of got that message. So they were sort of scaling back their expectations of what their life might be like and understanding that perhaps these are choices now that they have to make, that they cannot have it all. Would you say that that's an accurate sort of depiction of the differences?
Yeah. One of the fascinating observations comparing those two generations is that men seemed in their attitudes to become more egalitarian in terms of how, you know, two career relationships were going to work, where men were going to be more active at home and to be more equally distributing, you know, domestic responsibilities. However, to your point, women seem to have learned from the generation prior to them some hard lessons that perhaps the Gen Xers didn't quite envision with their more rosy or optimistic view about, you know, anything being possible. And so the Gen X women were less likely to have the view that relationships at home would be egalitarian than their forebears. So they saw it as necessary to make sacrifices more so than the people 20 years prior to them. The result, though, is that the attitudes about egalitarian relationships, two-career relationships, and how they were going to work converged. And so they're more on the same page now than men and women are than they were in the past. And that there's a note of optimism, I think, that comes from that observation.
Definitely. You as you mentioned, there's good news there. But it also, what was striking to me was just how much the men that you surveyed really were vocal about their concerns, about their worries. Yes, they see women's careers as being equal to theirs. They see their role in fatherhood as being much greater than the generations previous to them. But they were also concerned about how they were going to accomplish that as well. If I ask you to prognosticate a little bit into the future, if you were to survey the attitudes of the class of 2022, which would be 10 years forward, what kind of differences do you think you might find now?
Well, these last 10 years have been really tumultuous, of course. We all know that. And the trends that I observed in that earlier study continue. So birth rates continue to decline in our society. And it's a frightening prospect for the future. The pandemic had a radical shift in how people think about the relationship between work and the rest of life. There's a greater recognition that people have lives outside of work. There's also a greater recognition of the need for us as a society to be investing more in education, as people came to realize that professional educators do an enormous service to our society and need more support, and you know, not just economic, but all kinds of support in society. So there's a greater recognition of the need to support the whole person and to help people to create boundaries among the different parts of life and to invest in the whole person. That shift has definitely happened, and it's a good thing. However, the digital revolution has created an environment in which it's harder to focus on one thing at a time. It's harder to focus on work. People, young people especially, are even more socially isolated and alienated, feeling lonely. These are not my own personal observations. There's a lot of research supporting this. And I think that makes it harder for them to connect in ways that make them want to become parents. Of course, there's climate change, which has become a much more present issue in the minds of most thinking people, people who are informed about what's happening in the world. And when I had a discussion about the original findings of the baby bust study in a recent class in my MBA class on leadership from the point of view of the whole person, what I call total leadership, which is another outgrowth of the Work-Life Integration Project, another topic which I won't delve into here. But in that class, we had people reading this study findings and then learning about what the impact of climate change was going to be on the future and on future business ideas. And this was a heated debate that ensued about, well, is it moral to bring children into a world that is going to be uninhabitable? So there are those kinds of concerns on top of all the other sort of chaotic changes that are happening in our world that I think make it ever less likely for people to feel confident in taking up the role of being a parent.
I would love to have been a fly on the wall in one of your classrooms during one of those debates. It's certainly a debate that you hear pretty much in every corner now. Younger, older people, doesn't matter. It's just something that's on the top of our minds right now. Let me ask you, one of the things that I really like about this book is that it's not just a summary of your research. It's not just a narrative. You also offer these policy recommendations. Okay, Dr. Friedman, what can we do to fix it? And you put those in there. You have them at the society level, which is more cultural policy. You have it at the organizational level, and you have it at the individual level. And of course, we can't talk about all of them, but I was wondering if you'd pick out some of the ones that you feel are the most important, maybe the most doable, that we could start looking at.
Well, where we have seen some change at the policy level, though not nearly fast or enough, substantial enough, is in childcare and family leave. There is no reason why the United States cannot be the world leader in providing real support for families, all kinds of families. And that starts with family medical leave and childcare. We are woefully behind the rest of the world, the rest of the developed world for sure. You know, that's a matter of political will. We, again, have made some progress, not nearly enough. The real progress seems to be happening at the municipal and state levels that are more malleable, perhaps. But at the federal level, there's been very little. That's where I would start. And there are, you know, growing movements of political actors, of advocates of all sorts, activists who are pressing for this. And, you know, that's something that each and every one of us can have an impact on in terms of the people we vote for. At the organizational level, in businesses, all kinds of organizations, there has also been progress, probably more progress on that front, where you have the private sector responding to the demands of the labor market, wanting more flexibility and more control over their lives so that they can do the things that matter to them in all the different parts of their lives, including becoming parents. You see just greater understanding and respect for how to enact a real flexible workplace. There are still many sources of resistance to that, including traditional outmoded views about what a good working life looks like. But that is clearly changing and will continue to as young people, especially Gen Z, are, you know, pressing up against and pushing for change. At the individual level and at, you know, within families, I've done a lot of work on that in what I referred to earlier as the Total Leadership Program, which I created when I took a leave from Wharton for a few years, about 20 years ago, to become head of leadership development for Ford Motor Company. And what we did there was to develop a model of leadership that's about the whole person. We called it total leadership, and you can learn all about that and about the baby bus study and some other research at totalleadership.org. That is all about how you learn to become a better leader and have a richer life by knowing what's important to you, knowing who's important to you, and experimenting continually with how you get things done. And we've seen incredible results in helping people to find greater freedom and greater control of their lives, to be able to create a bit more harmony in their lives and to perform better and to grow faster as leaders. The most recent version of that work is a book called Parents Who Lead, where we took the essence of that total leadership model and practice, which is a course that I've been teaching at Wharton now for over 20 years, and we applied it to parents, people who are in the parenting project together. And so we had another set of Wharton alumni develop with us a set of tools that help parents get on the same page in terms of their values and their vision, who is most important to them and how to connect with them in meaningful ways, and how to experiment as a family with new ways to become more close to each other, more trusting, and better able to meet the needs of both parents, or however many parents there are, and the children as it grows in their communities. And in their business lives, people are more fruitful as a result, because they are consciously and deliberately creating positive change that works for them, their families, their businesses, and their communities. So there is hope. I think the best action that I've seen, and where I tend to focus, my background is as a psychologist, is at the individual and family levels, because I think that's where you can have the most tangible kind of impact. So there is some hope, but you know, I am pessimistic as we talk right now in February 2024 about the prospects for positive social change, you know, depending on what happens in the upcoming election. I think it's going to have a profound impact on so many aspects of social life, cultural life, including and especially in support for families and the kind of freedoms like control over our own bodies, for one, and also how we choose to live in the kinds of families we want to create. So political action at this time, I think, is an imperative for all of us to try to create the world we want.
We're definitely at a tipping point. One of the things I wanted to bring out when you are talking about the individual level is you really, in this book, you encourage people to push back, to challenge the stigmas of work being this badge of honor, this sense of heroism that I'm working 10, 12, 14 hours a day. You encourage, in particular, men to push back against the stigmas of masculinity. One of the phrases we use these days, toxic masculinity, to sort of engage in this. What I'm hearing is this sort of idea that it can come from the top, from management, from organizations, and it can also bubble up from the bottom, from people saying, no, this isn't really how I want to live my life. I think I can find a deeper, richer, more meaningful life in both work and at home. So I think that's a really important message in your book.
And that it is possible to not have it all at once, as you cited Betty Friedan speaking, but we can have more of what we want as people in society, parents and in other roles, if we take seriously the idea that to grow as a person, as a leader in your life, you need to really identify what's important to you, what's important to the people around you, and then continually look for opportunities to make change that's good for you and the people around you. So to get beyond the trade-off thinking that the term work-life balance connotes, it's a bad phrase because it compels you to think about the trade-offs you must make. Now, of course, trade-offs are inevitable, but there are more opportunities to create positive change that can have an impact on all the different parts of your life if you are intentional and smart about looking for those. It starts with knowing what's important to you, who's important, and then looking for ways that you can act to make a positive impact on the world. And there are many, many opportunities, and everyone can do this.
Yes.
So that does give me some hope, but it's a difficult road for us given the political environment that we're in right now.
Well, let's stay positive. I'm going to close, but I wanted to read just a couple of sentences from your book. You say the call to action described in this book is as relevant now as it was 10 years ago, perhaps more so. We can create a world in which people are free to choose whether to become parents and to make the parenting path more feasible for those who want to pursue it. That's exactly what we've been discussing in the last couple of minutes. What are your closing thoughts on that? Where do you hope we are in work-life integration? I won't use the word balance.
Well done.
50 years from now, where will we be?
I really think it's going to depend on what happens this year in the presidential election. And, you know, if we have people who are thinking about the future and thinking about us as a society who are in positions of, you know, executive authority, making choices about investing in families and the health and education that they need to be supported in growing healthy, well-nourished, and open-minded citizens, you know, that's going to help a lot. I think, you know, it's hard to predict how the world's going to be 50 years from now, you know, and it's, you know, my hope now as a grandfather, I'm the proud grandfather of three amazing people. And I, you know, I think a lot about them and about what their world's going to be like. And my hope is that we will make choices today that will enable them to be free to choose the lives that they want to live in all aspects of their lives. That's my hope. And I hold on to that hope, and I'm doing what I can to try to make that hope become real.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Again, the book is called Baby Bust, New Choices for Men and Women in Work and Family. This is the 10th anniversary edition. It is put out by Wharton School Press. You can download it or get a copy from your favorite bookseller. I want to thank Dr. Stuart Friedman for joining me. If you enjoyed this conversation, you can check out all our content on our website. It's just type Knowledge of Wharton into your search bar. I'm Angie Bastianini. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Angie.
For more insight from Knowledge at Wharton, please visit knowledge.wharton.upenn.edu.